I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a few minutes, a conversation about foster care. States are offsetting the cost of that care with money a child might receive in Social Security benefits. But critics are asking, shouldn't that money go instead to help the child when they age out of foster care? But first, has there been an Oprah effect? Over the weekend, talk show host Oprah Winfrey headlined a campaign swing through Iowa, South Carolina, and New Hampshire, saying Democratic presidential candidate Barack Obama inspired her to endorse a candidate for the first time. In Manchester, New Hampshire, Winfrey referenced the pundits who have wondered whether she can do for Barack Obama what she's done for Anna Karenina and other books she's picked for her book club.
They act like I don't know that y'all got some sense, you know? I know we all know the difference between book clubs and favorite things and free refrigerators. Barack Obama!
Richard Wolff is senior White House correspondent for Newsweek. He was with Obama and Winfrey at their two events in Iowa over the weekend. And Richard, you know, huge crowds. Put these numbers into context for us.
Well, the numbers are pretty astonishing. In Iowa, last time, 4 years ago, 122,000 people showed up to caucus, and that was a record in the Democratic race, 122,000 people. In the two events that Oprah Winfrey did for Barack Obama on Saturday in Iowa, about 30,000 people showed up. That, even with a record caucus-going attendance this cycle, she's reached 20-30% of the people who are likely to vote. And honestly, that's the kind of turnout money just can't buy.
But the question there is on that word likely. You know, are they likely to vote?
Well, that's a good question. And the campaigns are looking, they're really spending all their time trying to figure out who is going to vote. Because it is actually a low turnout, even among Democrats in Iowa, the people who show up to caucus. So really this opportunity with Oprah Winfrey was a dry run for the Obama organization. They could figure out who was going to show up, who said they were going to show up, who didn't show up, and of course all the people who they've never heard of before who signed up to the event because they were attracted by Oprah Winfrey.
Yeah, and we want to talk about who did and didn't show up, but we understand that while they were there, they were asked to immediately text message the Barack Obama campaign on their cell phones. So they got all this information, and they were asked to text message four other people. So quite a lot of work was done.
Right, and this is how they try to use the multiplier effect. You don't just have one person coming along. You get one person to bring somebody else. You don't just have a precinct captain. You have a precinct team. I mean, this is how there are a lot of comparisons made between Barack Obama and Howard Dean 4 years ago, because mostly because the guy is an insurgent candidate and a Washington outsider in some ways, but also because he's been driven by the Internet and Internet support. But that alone, seeing this kind of level of detailed organization, is a real sign how they've at least learned the lessons of Howard Dean and, frankly, moved way beyond there.
Well, it all worked for this voter in New Hampshire last night. This is Jenna Laverty of Sullivan, New Hampshire.
Average people don't have the time, money, or energy to invest in really, really researching their candidates. Oprah has a whole staff she can devote to it. So if she says she's done her homework, she's done her homework.
But Richard Wolff, is there a flip side to this, to that star power? Because you describe people leaving the hall in Des Moines after Oprah Winfrey spoke, before the candidate spoke, and you've seen this before.
That's right. There was a trickle of people. Not many. I mean, there were 18,000 people in that hall, and some were leaving as the candidate was speaking. And yet it reminded me of the first time Bill Clinton went out to speak with Hillary Clinton over the summer in Des Moines, and people were clearly there for him. Now, a much smaller crowd, maybe 3,000 people at the most. And there was a steady trickle of people that moved into a sort of stream of those leaving. So there's a downside. The candidate can be outshone. But frankly, there isn't a politician out there who has the kind of credibility and trust and emotional connection with an audience like Oprah does.
Well, and you call the fact that people do or don't show up the flake rate.
Yeah.
You know, people who promised to come and didn't, and you know, Howard Dean in Iowa late in 2003, his support was, well, some people said it was flaky, it wasn't real. So we're waiting to see whether this is real, is what you're saying.
Yeah, no, exactly. What matters is the people who don't show up as much as the people who do show up. They handed out maybe 23,000 tickets for that event, first event in Des Moines, and 5,000 didn't show up. Why didn't they show up? Were they duplicates? Were they just not feeling too good? Was it too cold? And it was certainly icy.
So they will be getting on that today to find out why.
Exactly.
Richard Wolff, senior White House correspondent for Newsweek. Thanks as always.
Anytime.
A recent lawsuit in North Carolina is bringing attention to the way states fund foster care programs. The case involves a 17-year-old known as John G., who's been in and out of foster care most of his life. When his adoptive father died, John G. inherited his house and started receiving Social Security death benefits of $538 a month. John used that money to pay the $221 monthly mortgage on that house in the hopes of living in it once he aged out of foster care. But the Guilford County Department of Social Services took John's Social Security money to offset the cost of his foster care. John sued and recently won the latest round of his lawsuit. That could set a precedent throughout North Carolina and possibly nationwide. So the county plans to appeal. Well, what's at stake here? It's estimated that states take $150 million in Social Security payments from foster kids every year. And if other foster kids start suing, as John G. did, the state says a huge stream of revenue could be at risk. For more on this case, we start with Lewis Pitts. He represented John G. He works for Legal Aid North Carolina. He's also on the board of the First Star Child Advocacy Group. Lewis, tell us a little bit more about John G.
Well, as you mentioned, John spent a lot of time in foster care. He was lucky enough to have an adoptive father who had a Habitat for Humanity's home. Unfortunately, that father died when John was about four. He then was in the care of that man's girlfriend, who was abusive and neglectful. Then he was adopted by an aunt. She was abusive and neglectful. These folks primarily seemed to hang on to John because of his house and his Social Security benefit check. About 2004, he went into foster care with the Guilford County Department of Social Services.
Why was he, you know, living with these different adoptive parents and relatives in the first place? What happened to his parents?
Well, his mother was, I think, drug addicted and just didn't have anything to do with him. You know, we have in our nation 500,000 foster care children. John is one of those unfortunate kids whose natural parents and then subsequent parents failed to properly take care of him.
Well, now, as you say, he is in foster care, and the county has been taking his Social Security funds, the ones he was using to pay the mortgage on the house. Federal regulations say the county has the right to use those funds to help cover the cost of foster care. So what's your argument against that?
What the federal law says is that a payee who's receiving the benefits in behalf of a minor can, that it is permissible to reimburse themselves for out-of-pocket cost of maintenance of the child. But the overarching requirement in the federal law is that any use of the benefits have to be for the best interest of the child, of the beneficiary. And what unfortunately was happening to John when he became a ward of government care was the same thing that had happened to him when he was in the care of drug abusers and neglectful parents. They began to pocket his money and refused to pay this mortgage on the Habitat home.
We're going to speak with somebody from the county in just a moment. They say they're taking using the monies to pay for his care, but you're saying that either way, the money's not going to pay for the mortgage.
Well, that's correct. Well, what's happening is the caretaker, the legal guardian, was not using this money for John's best interest. It's in no way could be deemed in John's best interest to have a governmental entity pocket his money and have John lose his home when John has no legal debt to pay. Fortunately, we don't require foster children to repay society and the government for tending to them in foster care.
But a lot of people would be surprised how much social services does depend on Social Security. For instance, it's counted as income in care for the elderly. Most counties will take a portion or percentage of Social Security for Medicaid coverage for the elderly. You know, that a lot of the social services depend on Social Security.
And if there's one thing that I would hope that our listeners would take away from this program is a new realization that we are starving the budgets of the entities that are supposed to be caring for the needy and are becoming a society that takes those funds away from the needy to try to reimburse the government. We have to fully fund the services that are promised to the children. But the general voting public is not aware of how these systems are starved for resources. So I can relate and be sympathetic with the Department of Social Services and their need to find more funds. I have absolutely no sympathy for them when they decide to take it, usually surreptitiously and below the radar, from needy children, as opposed to candidly and honestly go to the public and go to the legislatures and say, we don't have the money to carry out our statutory mandate of caring for the children. We, the public, need to pay to care for abused and neglected children.
Well, what options does John G. have when he ages out?
His options are pretty much slim. Defend for himself. And that's why being able to have a roof over his head can make the difference in whether this child becomes another statistic. He has a chance to get out, hopefully to continue or finish his education, get a job, and have a home. There's no following benefits that go with a foster child.
Lewis Pitts is the lawyer for John G. He's also a board member of the First Star Child Advocacy Group. Lewis, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Well, now we're going to turn to Lynn Shifton. She's the attorney representing Guilford County's Department of Social Services. Lynn, I want to give you a chance to respond. Mr. Pitts said that you're behaving, or the county is behaving, just the way John G.'s relatives did, pocketing this money, not using it for his best interest.
Well, I can't speak about the specifics of John's case as Lewis can, but I can just tell you in general that the regulations with dealing with Social Security allow DSS, or allow any agency, to that the money be used for the current cost of care, which means that, yes, you can have a choice as to do it or not do it, but by choosing to do it, no one is breaking any law. It's an allowable, discretionary choice that's made.
Does his Social Security money go directly to his foster care?
It goes toward the cost of care. His cost of care is more than his Social Security money that he receives.
As we said, the North Carolina Court of Appeals ruled against the county last month, ruled in favor of John G.
Mm-hmm.
And now we understand you plan an appeal.
That's correct.
On what grounds?
We feel, as I just indicated, that the regulations allow the agency to do this.
But, you know, as Lewis Pitts just said, allowing is one thing. That allows you also to make a different kind of choice. Why would you want to take the funds from a kid who's going to age out of the foster system and will need that money and would need that home? It would seem that his having a home to move into would save the system ultimately so much money.
Well, let me correct one thing that Mr. Pitts said when he said, your question was, what happens when he ages out? And I think Mr. Pitts responded that he's out there to fend for himself. That's not exactly correct. When juveniles age out, when they turn 18, they can enter into a voluntary placement agreement with the agency to continue in a placement should they choose to do that, with the understanding that they're either in school or working. There's a plan in effect to help them for the next 3 years of their lives.
That's Lynn Shifton. She's the attorney representing Guilford County, North Carolina, in their case to seize a foster child's Social Security benefits. Some states have regulations that enable them to seize any asset from a foster child, even money they might make from a job. We'll have more on that. And later, the latest Supreme Court ruling today, it's on crack cocaine sale. We'll have that as well. Back in a minute, here and now. Picking up where we left off with Lynn Shifton in North Carolina, she's representing the Guilford County Department of Social Services in a case against a 17-year-old foster child known as John G. He receives Social Security death benefits and wants to use that money to pay the mortgage on a house he inherited. Lynn says the county is entitled to that money to pay for John's foster care. And Lynn, as we were saying, John is 17 years old, about to age out of foster care. You say there are support systems in place for him, but it wouldn't be the independent life that he might have had if he had a home waiting for him.
Do you know many 18-year-olds that walk into that situation? I mean, when parents who are not involved with the court system receive money, receive benefits for their child, they use it, and we stand in the same way that the agency is using it. They use it for house payments. They use it for the other needs of the household, including the juvenile. And DSS stands in the stead of a parent.
Well, let's expand on that, because the funds that are now being received by John G. are death benefits, but kids also receive disability payments in the event a child going into foster care has a mental or physical disability. If the county takes that money that's earmarked for a certain child because that child has a disability, does that money go towards additional services for that child, disability
additional
services?
No, it goes toward the cost of care of the juvenile.
But if these are additional payments to a child, shouldn't they get the additional benefits? In other words, shouldn't those payments go towards care of that child above and beyond whatever just the foster care is?
Again, I'm looking at what the rules and regulations dealing with Social Security benefits indicate, and what it says is that the money is to go toward their current cost of care and maintenance, and we apply the rules.
I guess that's the question. You know, applying the rules is one thing, but when they seem so out of whack with the needs of the child, why not bend the rules a little bit? Why not let a 17-year-old invest in a house, and why not apply disability payments to extra disability care?
Well, first of all, it's not an option to bend the rules. It's the rules are there for a reason, and there are repercussions when you don't follow the rules, and that would never be something that I would advise my client to do.
Is one of the concerns on the part of the county that, you know, this case only concerns $500 a month, but that might set precedent?
Well, absolutely. Without being able to use the monetary resources, I cannot imagine the amount of tax increases because, Mr. Pitts is right. There are no funds. The funds are not out there. The counties don't get the funds, extra funds that are needed. So these resources have to be used to meet the obligations of caring for the juveniles.
As we said at the outset, the Congressional Research Service estimates that states take $150 million in Social Security payments from kids. So that's $150 million that would have to be made up somewhere.
That's exactly my point, yes.
Lynn Shifton is the attorney representing Guilford County's Department of Social Services. And again, the county wants to use the Social Security death benefits paid to a young man called John G. to cover the cost of his foster care. Lynn, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, this is obviously a complicated issue, the issue of how states fund foster care. And to help us understand more, we go to Dan Hatcher, assistant professor of law at the University of Baltimore School of Law. You wrote a 2006 Cardoza Law Review article on this issue. First of all, we were hearing this from Lynn, but how does foster care funding work?
Well, that's a complicated question. The total foster care funding across the country comes from a wide variety of sources, including federal, state, and local, and that total funding, according to numbers by the Urban Institute, is somewhere over $23 billion, and that was as of 2004.
And I'm sure people are stunned to hear these numbers, you know, because it speaks to just how many foster kids that there are. But even though, you know, $150 million for all the kids across the country who are losing Social Security is, maybe a drop in the bucket of foster care expenses, just that $500 a month to this one young man, you know, means the difference between having a home when he ages out and not having a home when he ages out. So, you know, your thoughts on whether states or counties should be able to use Social Security money to pay for foster care.
And this whole process of funding, the Social Security benefits, which are either survivor benefits or SSI disability benefits, are now considered as an income source by states, but they weren't set up that way. Because states are so broke, they're looking for money wherever they can get it. And in this case, unfortunately, from the very children that they're supposed to be helping. I've been able to find no evidence whatsoever that when the states take the Social Security benefits from the children, that money is actually then earmarked for the children, for foster care programs, but rather just funneled into the general state coffers and maybe just as likely to be used to build a highway as to be used to fund an additional foster care worker spot.
Well, there are people who disagree with you, I'm sure you are aware of the Washington State lawsuit that went to the Supreme Court. The Children's Defense Fund sided with the state, saying that children do receive better care when the state has access to their Social Security funds. And the Supreme Court sided with the state in that case. Why would the Children's Defense Fund side with the state?
Well, there's actually been differing opinions among national child advocacy groups across the country on this issue. The gist of the policy concerns are that by states being allowed to use or take foster children's Social Security benefits to reimburse themselves, that gives them an incentive then to screen children for disabilities and then apply for SSI on their behalf. Unfortunately, I agree that bribery works. I just don't think it's good policy.
What do you think needs to happen here, Dan? Because it seems like part of the problem is sort of this ad hoc way that foster care is funded.
Right. Funding for foster care is unfortunately just a mess. I think there's a whole host of things that need to be done. First, I would encourage that these Social Security benefits for foster children be used as they were intended to actually help the children, not just as a money resource for the kids, but as a planning tool, again, to help them in their future plans to transition out of care. Right now, under very complex rules that just make no common sense, only children who come from extremely poor families and are brought into foster care are eligible for federal reimbursement, that the states would be eligible for federal reimbursements. If a child is in a poor household, the state would know that that kid comes with money attached, with federal funds attached. If they're not, the child does not come with money attached. That can't do anything but create perverse and unwise incentives.
Dan Hatcher, Assistant Professor of Law at the University of Baltimore School of Law. We said this was complicated, and we want to thank you for trying to help us straighten it out. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Okay, tomorrow on Here and Now. Remember, read my lips, no new taxes. Well, we'll look at the other Bush presidency. A new book argues that George H.W. Bush was in many respects a great president, despite flaws. That's tomorrow. Still ahead today, author Myra Kallman. That's after the news, Here and Now. The Supreme Court ruled today that federal judges do not have to follow federal sentencing guidelines in crack cocaine cases. The ruling marks a major shift in the debate over sentencing laws that treat the use or sale of crack cocaine as a far worse offense than powdered cocaine, 100 times worse, as we're going to hear, a disparity many saw as racist, since black offenders were more likely to deal in crack cocaine, whites in cocaine powder. Joining us on the line, Jonathan Turley, professor at George Washington University Law School. And Jonathan, to start, explain that 100-to-1 aspect of this story.
Well, it's been a long controversy, as you noted. The racial underpinnings of it were something of note, not just of politicians and activists, but also judges. Judges often complained that under the sentencing guidelines, you would get a minimum of 5 years in prison for 5 grams of cocaine. And that's 100 times more than what you would get for the same amount in powdered cocaine.
So the 5 years was for crack cocaine.
That's correct.
Right.
And the obvious disparity was really producing a troubling, you know, fact for many judges, that they looked at these defendants and said, why? But I think that underlying this is still this ongoing debate over the sentencing guidelines themselves.
Right. Well, let's get to this case first and then go broader, because this was the case of Derek Kimbrough of Norfolk, Virginia, a vet who was arrested with crack and powdered cocaine. A federal judge found that the crack powder disparity in sentencing was ridiculous and sentenced, or his words, and sentenced Kimbrough to 15 years, 4.5 less than the guidelines. Today, as we said, the Supreme Court said the lesser sentence that judge gave could stand. Now, 3 years ago, the Supreme Court ruled judges could reasonably disagree with sentencing guidelines. So first of all, why was today's ruling even needed?
Well, first of all, you know, as you note, this isn't a huge change. I mean, the guidelines were saying that it would be 19 to 22 years. This judge decided that 15 years was enough. I think most people would agree that 15 years is a pretty heavy sentence. So
right.
It's not like this guy won the lottery. But in terms of the ruling 3 years ago, the court said that the guidelines would not be treated as mandatory, that in fact judges could have some flexibility in sentencing. Since then, judges have largely stayed close to the guidelines. It's just that they have, on occasion, departed. The conservatives really did not like that earlier decision. But all of the apocalyptic predictions have not come true. I'm a criminal defense attorney, and I can tell you I'm in court all the time listening to judges citing the sentencing guidelines and trying to stay close to them. The idea is that we want to preserve uniformity across the country. But there's also this problem with the guidelines themselves, that the guidelines allowed the Sentencing Commission and Congress to continually tweak sentences for political reasons.
I'm just going to jump in for a second and say that the guidelines are set up by Congress and the Sentencing Commission, in the case, for instance, of the crack cocaine versus powdered cocaine, has asked Congress to change that ratio, and they haven't.
Right. And the problem is that politicians love to pass criminal legislation that makes them look tougher on crime. And that turns our courts into sort of unwitting, avenues for these political demonstrations. The other thing that it did is that we select federal judges after they have been remarkably successful in their life. They become accomplished lawyers, and we wait for them to get 20, 30 years of experience. We put them on the court, and some of the judges have complained to me that as soon as they get there, we tell them, don't use any of that experience.
Yeah.
You know, just basically treat this like an accounting process. Well, a lot of these judges said that's not how these cases really are, that if you really want to do justice, you need to let the judge make some variation so that they can reflect these changes.
Well, now we have this judge in this one case who did. The Supreme Court said he could. Does the Supreme Court decision mean, though, that judges can completely ignore the guidelines?
No, it doesn't. Judge Ginsburg said that this allowed for some reasonable levels of discretion. What I was surprised at, frankly, was the vote, 7-2. I expected it to be closer. And as usual, Thomas and Alito were found in dissent. It really does sort of fulfill the view of Alito as being pretty much an extremist on these issues, according to some who...
Well, what did he say? What did he say in the dissent?
Well, Alito and Thomas just said that they don't want any discretion to be given to judges in these cases, and that they don't want any disparity of sentencing to be produced. Now, for some, that is a demonstration that the two of them remain faithful to sort of congressional authority and the principle behind the sentencing guidelines. Mm-hmm. To others, it tends to reflect their view as being exceptionally pro-government. And you sort of take it for as you will. But what's interesting is that many of their conservative colleagues did not support them in that. It was a 7-2 vote where they said, this is not going to bring the walls crashing down, that we need to rely on these judges and support them when they make these tweaks.
Well, the Sentencing Commission wants to end the disparity between crack and powdered cocaine sentences. In fact, members are supposed to vote tomorrow on revised guidelines that would do just that. But first of all, can they do that without Congress? And if they can do it, or if these sentencing guidelines in this one area fall, what effect will that have?
Well, I think this decision will help the Sentencing Commission a lot because the court says that you can make variations in this regard. And also another case that came down today, Gall versus the United States, was not a drug case. It was a case involving the sale of ecstasy. But in that case, a judge awarded a sense of probation when the guidelines called for 30 to 37 months. And once again, the court, with Alito and Thomas in dissent, said a judge is allowed to do that. So I think that what the court is doing is it's supporting the traditional role of judges and saying, have at it, but be reasonable.
And the effect, we understand, almost 20,000 inmates could soon apply for that sentence reduction.
They can. There is a method by which you can go for a post-conviction, even post-appeal reduction, and I expect that some of them will very well look for that.
Well, in an October editorial, the Washington Post predicted the slow, painful death of federal sentencing guidelines. I just want to be sure we've heard what you are saying. Do you agree? Is this a nail in the coffin? Is this the coffin, or is this just one of those tweaks?
No, I don't think it's a nail in the coffin. I think that, I think the problem is that people view the guidelines in extreme terms only. The purpose of the guidelines was not a bad one. People like Kennedy and conservatives agreed, including people like Hatch and Kennedy, joined in supporting the guidelines. They wanted to see greater uniformity so that people can rely on the federal system to produce like results in different states. But it went way too far. It became mandatory. It took the judges out of it. They sat there with, green eye shades on and just basically did the math. Well, that doesn't make for a very good justice system. I think that right now we've got the perfect balance. We have a guideline that says, look, we want you to try to stay within this range. But we also say, we're going to trust you. And if you see compelling reasons why it shouldn't be here, we'll support you. And what the court is saying today is, you better be reasonable because we're going to be here watching.
Jonathan Turley, professor of law at George Washington University. Jonathan, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, I want to take a quick look at some stories coming up later in the week. We're going to visit with a soldier, one of the first in the country to stay in the military but get care at a private hospital to help him recover from the signature wound of the Iraq War, traumatic brain injury. Also, do you believe in God? 18 cultural icons were asked that question. We'll hear their answers. You're listening to Here and Now. Nobel laureate, scholar, and Holocaust survivor Elie Wiesel is famous for his searing essays, memoirs, and reality-inspired works of fiction. But in Boston tonight, a previously unknown play written by Wiesel almost 40 years ago is being staged for the first time. Here and Now's Andrea Shea has the story.
While his play is set in a Jewish ghetto during World War II, Elie Wiesel has said it's not about the Holocaust. Still, director Gila Clara Kasu says the plot and themes in Once Upon a Time are heavy.
It's dealing with human responsibilities when someone has to decide who to kill.
That someone is a young Jew named Daniel. His plight unfolds when a Nazi commander randomly picks him and two other men out of a crowd. Then he tells Daniel to kill one. If he doesn't comply, the commander will murder 30 of Daniel's neighbors. While this game is brutal and raises questions about sacrificing a single life to save many, Kasu says Wiesel's play is as much about hope as it is about cruelty, death, and despair.
Inside of the ghetto, even if the people were scared, they were still loving each other, hating each other. And this idea of those people continuing having feelings that unite them no matter what was very interesting to see that humanity was still here.
Kasu says it's also interesting that while Wiesel wrote this play in 1968 for a French radio program, it's never been staged or translated into English until now. Cassus, a 28-year-old native of France, is also a Ph.D. candidate at Boston University, where Wiesel teaches. When the professor presented his French text to Cassus, she says,
Mr. Wiesel gave me more or less carte blanche. I let him know about the cast. I told him, of course, to let me know if there was something he wanted me to change. But he let me terribly free, terribly free. And that was the scary part and the most interesting part also.
The cast includes professional actors, students, a rabbi, Holocaust survivors, and the children of Holocaust survivors. Here's Yankel Pollock playing Frank, the resistance leader in the ghetto.
People in the ghetto were dying of hopelessness, disgusting diseases, solitude, heartbreak. But I was happy, almost content. I was helping to make, to remake history. At the very heart of this horror, I remained pure, just, and innocent.
For Pollock, the chance to act in Wiesel's play has given him the chance to connect to his father, who was a baby during the Holocaust.
For me, growing up and seeing pictures of children in the concentration camps or in the ghettos, it was always something where I would try to imagine myself in that place. So now, having this opportunity to actually work on putting myself into this character and into the ghetto, I almost feel like I belong there. And I'm finally having the opportunity to really live, in a sense, what most of my family have gone through.
While much of the cast in Once Upon a Time is Jewish, Amy Bettina isn't. She says playing Alishka, a young woman in the ghetto, was tough because part of an actor's job is to relive what their character is suffering.
So I had to stop trying to connect my own bad experiences and some of the worst experiences I've ever had and just admit that nothing that I've ever experienced and probably will ever experience, I hope, anything like the Jews experienced during the Holocaust.
Director Gila Clara Kasu says presenting this play during Hanukkah is a powerful reminder for everyone.
So I felt it was marvelous to have the idea of lighting a candle, not only for the victims of the Shoah, but also to realize how precious is life. And when the life is preserved, we should all together celebrate, no matter what.
Kasu says the play's premiere is also a tribute to Elie Wiesel and his life's work. In fact, Wiesel will be at the performance tonight, and Kasu says she and the cast are very excited to hear what he thinks of their interpretation.
Here Now's Andrea Shea. For more on Elie Wiesel's play Once Upon a Time, go to our website, here-now.org. Coming up, author and illustrator Mara Kullman, Here and Now. Mm-hmm. Myra Kallman's new book, The Principles of Uncertainty, is a stroll through life as observed by this author and illustrator. For instance, following a drawing of George Gershwin, there's this handwritten text. Gershwin died at the age of 38 of a brain tumor. He's buried in the same cemetery as my husband. My husband died at the age of 49. I could collapse thinking about that. But I don't want to talk about that. I want to say that I love that George is nearby under a leafy tree, and Ira, too. It is very cozy. The book is a collection of the monthly columns Kallman wrote and illustrated for the New York Times online edition in 2006 and 2007. And Myra Kallman joins us now from New York to talk about whatever she does want to talk about. The title of the book, Myra, we know, comes from Heisenberg's Uncertainty Principle in Physics. It would seem appropriate. But tell us more about what that title means to you.
Basically, the thought of the book is that we live our lives in a state of very vulnerable and precarious situations where we try to find meaning and reason and love and joy, but we never know what's going to happen, and it's a very fragile thing, this life.
Well, and there's a sort of a summation of that thinking. I think on page 46 there's a beautiful illustration of a rabbit wearing two pairs of shoes and striped socks, I should add, and over that you write, "What can I tell you? The realization that we are all, you and me, going to die, and the attending disbelief, isn't that the central premise of everything? It stops me dead in my tracks a dozen times a day. Do you think I remain frozen? No. I spring into action." Do you stop in your tracks a dozen times a day?
At least a dozen times a day. And the shoes that are on the bunny are actually shoes that I have. I don't wear four shoes. I wear two shoes. But they are a slightly large pair of shoes that I bought in a thrift shop in England. And they remind me to walk carefully and slowly and to look around me. So they kind of slow down time, which is my deep desire to do.
Well, and it allows you, it seems, to look at anything you want, think and say anything you want. The pictures range from, oh, there's Dostoevsky, to a garbage can you saw in Paris, to a man dancing on salt. Why is he dancing on salt?
He's a relative of ours, and he's an idiot. He wanted to dance. he thought it would be a good way to impress his girlfriend, to show her that he could dance on salt. It's as simple and as sad as that.
Well, and there's parking stubs and your children, George Gershwin. Is this how you also inhabit your life, you know, outside of books? You just sort of say and think out loud whatever you want?
It seems to be that the more I do it, the luckier I am. And I really do. And I don't want there to be a separation between my work and my life. And in the ideal world, I'm wandering around. I'm like a 24-hour journalist. And I get to archive all the information and all the things that are funny and strange and beautiful.
Well, you say you do like to actually walk and observe people, literally follow them. You say, "I have a specialty of love, old people who have difficulty walking. I walk behind them quietly and imitate their steps, and my heart goes out to them." Do you really do that?
Yeah, because it's also, I mean, it's very much like being in a ballet, which I enjoy thinking that I'm in a lot of the time, or in some kind of ballet opera, which is something that I would actually like to do with this work.
Huh.
But the point of the whole thing is that I really write and paint people who I fall in love with. And that's a lot of people, because I'm always amazed at how heroic and wonderful people are to make it from morning till night.
Hmm. I open another page. On the left is a drawing of a cheeseburger deluxe. And then to the right in the panel, a woman is sitting in a diner. You've written over it, "You cannot order a deluxe grilled cheese sandwich. There are limits to deluxe." There you go.
Right. That's a philosophy in and of itself. And I met this wonderful woman in a diner, in a coffee shop in on the Upper West Side. And we started talking about things. And she had come to New York because she wanted to be an opera singer, but it didn't work out. So, the level of people's dreams enters, it's kind of constant dream state in a way that I can flow in and out of and have lunch, too.
Well, there's not just paintings, there's photographs. Here I'm looking at a young girl. She looks like she's a bridesmaid. Yeah. Underneath you've written, "I hope." There's a woman walking away in a bright green dress. Underneath it says, "The sun will blow up in 5 billion years. Why, by the way, the walking away from you?
When people walk away from you, they are not aware that you're looking at their back. And I guess it's a more vulnerable or touching way of looking at people. It's a journey. It's like watching everybody's journey.
For some reason, I'm thinking of Wings of Desire and how the angels were observing everyone and they didn't know.
In making sense of this world, what's nice to think is that there are some people that you're connected to, even if you see them for a minute. I mean, there are people who are part of your life and your family and your tribal connection. And then there are all the other people who are here, too, who are, you know, dazzling.
Well, your family does come up in the book over and over again. Your kids, Lulu and Alexander. In fact, we also have one of your children's books here, the Hey, Willie, See the Pyramids.
That's my favorite children's book, and it was the first one I wrote.
Describing scenes that have a lot of color. A girl in a green dress bought 3 oranges and a chicken for dinner. Then she dressed her brother neatly in red pants and a little blue shirt. They danced and danced until it was late. Why is it your favorite?
You know, maybe because it was the first one I wrote, but it was also the one about my family, and it's about when I wrote it when my children were little, and the magical atmosphere that was in the home when I wrote that book and how much they were a part of it, and that it was my opportunity to be a writer and an artist again. You know, I had been doing editorial illustration for many years, but this was the way to once again enter into literature, which I'd been wanting to do for a while, so...
Well, now, your book for adults, The Principles of Uncertainty. You go from Russian history to Freud and Tolstoy, Abraham Lincoln, of course, your family. What was the overarching goal with the book?
I wanted to achieve myselfness. I wanted to achieve the most natural kind of being in my life, in the thought processes that I have. And even though I edit the work, it's not a stream of consciousness by any means. But it is a sense of how I think. And when I spoke to when the Times asked me to do a column for them, what we agreed on is that I would be myself. And that was an incredible opportunity. And it really spoils you for all future work.
I'm just going to open arbitrarily to give people an idea. Okay, so here I've opened, and there's a painting that you've done of a wall with a radiator. You see a little bit of a window.
Right.
It spans 2 pages, and you write, Wittgenstein, the philosopher, designed a house for his sister, every inch and every item. Here is the radiator. To say that he found God in the details would be an understatement. But how would he define God?
Yeah, that's a big question in the book. You know, I talk about Spinoza and Freud and Wittgenstein and these great thinkers who really helped illuminate the nature of, well, you know, from the 1600s through our century now. But sometimes the large issues become complicated and it's best to focus on a cup of tea or a radiator and then to keep on going. I mean, I like the momentum of mulling over something and then saying, well, I'm not going to figure that out, so I better go and have a nice slice of cheesecake or something. So, but Wittgenstein was really an amazing philosopher. And I don't know enough about him to really discuss it, so you know, people shouldn't ask me any questions. But you know, the ability to articulate with language what is in your soul or in your heart or who you are is a really complex one and something that I think about a lot. Like, are the sentences that I'm saying actually explaining what I mean, and is the person listening actually understanding? It's hard to know.
Oh, I think we are doing both. Myra Kallman, her book is The Principles of Uncertainty. For more, go to here-now.org. We'll link you to her website. Myra, thank you.
Thank you very much.